Usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of clinical precision, right?
Oh, absolutely. It feels engineered.
Exactly. It feels totally engineered. Like if you fall and break your arm, you go to the hospital, they take an x-ray, and you get that jagged white line on a black background.
Right. It's visible. It's binary. You're broken or you're not.
Yeah. And the treatment targets that exact specific point of failure. The doctor just points to the screen and says, there it is.
And that's comforting, I mean, because it's localized. You fix the one spot.
Right. But then if you step into the world of large-scale global agriculture, suddenly that x-ray machine is just, it's completely thrown out the window.
Oh, yeah. The precision is just gone.
Totally gone. If you look at how we farm, especially how we manage pests, we are looking at a landscape that is honestly incredibly messy.
It has historically been about blunt force trauma, really.
Yes. Blunt force trauma. You don't surgically remove a pest in modern farming. You basically just, carpet bomb the entire environment with chemicals.
And you just cross your fingers and hope the good stuff survives while the bad stuff dies.
Which is wild when you think about it.
It is the absolute definition of a chemical guessing game. I mean, we rely on these broad spectrum, untargeted applications. And the alarming part for you, for everyone, is that this method is becoming increasingly rapidly ineffective.
We're hitting a wall, basically.
Oh, you're hitting a biological wall.
Hard. And that biological wall, is exactly why we are here today. We are diving into a stack of incredibly detailed engineering infographics, agricultural market data, and peer-reviewed research papers. And they outline something called photonic insecticides.
A very fancy term.
Right. Very sci-fi. But I want to set the stage for you, the listener, right out of the gate. This sounds like it was ripped straight out of a science fiction novel, but it is a highly engineered, very present agricultural reality.
Yeah, photonic insecticides is certainly a very elegant academic way of describing the technology. But if we strip away the jargon, what we're really talking about is a system of autonomous flying drones that, well, they hunt down and shoot individual insect pests with lasers.
I mean, I still cannot get over that premise.
It's a lot to take in.
Shooting bugs with lasers from
Yeah.
flying robots. It sounds like a late-night video game.
It totally does.
But our mission today is to move entirely past the sci-fi shock value of that concept. We're going to unpack exactly how this works on a mechanical, physical level.
And we really need to emphasize the urgency here.
Yeah, because by the end of this conversation, you won't just understand the wild optical engineering. You will understand why this represents a massive, fundamental economic shift in global agriculture.
Right, because this isn't just technology being developed for the sake of having cool technology.
No, the agricultural sector desperately needs this.
Desperately. Our current chemical pest control methods are fundamentally failing. I mean, they are facing massive biological resistance from pests. The collateral damage to the environment and soil health is becoming entirely unsustainable.
And regulators are stepping in, right?
Oh, absolutely. They are banning older chemicals faster than new ones can be invented. So we are being forced to innovate because the old way is quite literally breaking down.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we even get to the lasers and the flying robots, we really need to understand why the current model is broken.
We have to look at the history of agriculture and how we arrived at this breaking point.
Right.
So, to understand the paradigm shift this technology represents, you have to look deeply at the current standard. And that relies almost entirely on treating entire hectares of land with chemical insecticides.
Just coating everything.
Everything. If a farmer has an infestation, let's use the Colorado potato beetle as our prime example today.
Notoriously devastating pest, by the way.
Oh, it's awful. But if a farmer sees them, they do not just treat the beetles. They load up a tractor or a massive drone and they spray the entire field, the soil, the stems, the leaves, the surrounding air. It all gets coated in a lethal compound.
Which means you are treating a vastly larger surface area than the actual physical footprint of the pests themselves.
Exactly.
Like if you calculate the mass of the beetles versus the mass of the field being sprayed, it's just a terrifying ratio of wasted chemical.
It is incredibly inefficient. And this blanket spraying has two massive compounding negative consequences.
Okay, what's the first one?
First is the ecological disaster. When you blanket spray a hectare, you kill non-target beneficial insects.
Also, like ladybugs and stuff.
Right, ladybugs, parasitic wasps, all the natural predators that might naturally keep the pest populations in check. Plus, you risk killing pollinators, which are essential for surrounding ecosystems.
So you basically create a biological vacuum in the field.
And nature abhors a vacuum.
It always does.
Precisely. Which leads to the second consequence, and perhaps the more dangerous one from a purely economic and food security standpoint.
Which is
You drive rapid, aggressive chemical resistance.
evolution in real time.
Exactly. The Colorado potato beetle is globally famous for this. It is an evolutionary marvel in the worst way possible. It mutates and adapts its metabolism so quickly that chemicals which decimated populations a decade ago are practically used as a condiment by the beetles today.
A condiment. That's a terrifying visual.
But it's true, they are resistant to over 50 different active ingredients across all major insecticide classes.
Wow, 50.
Over 50. So the solutions are becoming less effective, farmers have to spray more often with higher concentrations, and regulators are rightfully heavily restricting the approval of new, harsher chemicals.
It's a literal arms race, and the bugs are winning.
They really are.
So the current model is failing. And the paradigm shift, the big idea driving this entire stack of engineering specs we're looking at today, is defined by a simple revolutionary phrase: treat the insect, not the hector.
That is the core philosophy.
I love that. Treat the insect, not the hector.
We are moving away from what the industry calls the flying tanker model and moving toward an intelligent hunter model.
Okay, flying tanker. Paint that picture for me.
So if you think about current agricultural spray drones, the ones you might see flying over fields today, they are massive pieces of machinery. They are designed to carry tens of kilograms of liquid payload.
Right, they're huge.
A spray drone is essentially an aerial tractor optimized to carry material. It has a huge tank, heavy pumps, massive batteries just to generate the lift required for that tank, and it requires constant logistical support on the ground to refill the chemicals like every few minutes.
I want to make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. It sounds like the difference between using a highly calibrated sniper rifle versus carpet bombing an entire city neighborhood just because you heard there might be one burglar in a single house.
That is a very accurate way to describe the disparity in the methods. One relies on mass coverage, the other relies on absolute localized precision.
But I have to push back here because this is where my skepticism kicks in.
Sure, go ahead.
In a video game, a sniper rifle is great, right? It's a controlled environment. But in reality, a farm is chaotic. It's windy, the lighting changes every second, the terrain is uneven, bugs are tiny. We're talking millimeters across, and they are constantly moving.
It's a very dynamic environment, yes.
Right. So is this technology actually precise enough to pull this off without collateral damage? Are we really realistically swapping tons of chemical liquid for a laser beam?
We absolutely are. And the reason it works is because of a fundamental shift in what the drone is hauling.
Okay. What is it hauling if not chemicals?
Unlike the spray drone, the laser drone isn't carrying physical material, it is carrying intelligence.
Intelligence.
Yes. We are talking about a lightweight platform, roughly a 1 kilogram class drone, which is incredibly small, carrying perhaps a 300 gram payload. It's not hauling water and poison, it is hauling photons, optical sensors, and processing power. To truly answer your question about how this precision is achieved in a chaotic environment, we have to look at the anatomy of how this drone actually executes a strike.
Let's do that because the engineering outline in these specs is honestly wild. We need to move from the theory of precision to the actual mechanical steps of executing a microscopic strike from the air.
It's a very specific sequence.
Yeah, according to the breakdown of the data, the system follows a tightly choreographed four-step process.
The first step is the macro level intelligence gathering. Step one is fly high and scan.
Okay, so it starts way up.
Right. The drone, or a fleet of scouting drones, flies high over the crop canopy, taking high-resolution, wide-angle pictures. Artificial intelligence algorithms analyze these images in near real time to detect the specific visual signatures of clustered pests.
So they're looking for the damage or the bugs themselves.
The bugs themselves, mostly. What they are doing is creating a heat map of beetle locations across a massive field.
So it's not just randomly wandering the field hoping to bump into a bug, it's mapping the battlefield first.
It has to. Agriculture operates on huge scales. The system relies on the fact that pest infestations usually start in clustered hotspots before they spread.
They clump together.
Exactly. By mapping these hotspots, you enable highly efficient targeting. Once it has that map, the system transitions to step two, which is fly closer, and locate in 3D.
Okay, so it dives down.
Yes. The specialized laser drone descends to the identified hotspot and uses an onboard stereo camera, which is similar to how human eyes give us depth perception, to locate each specific beetle in three-dimensional space.
How close is it at this point?
It is looking at roughly a 1 square meter field of view at this point. It isolates the exact X, Y, and Z coordinates of the insect on a leaf.
So now it knows the bug is, say, on the third leaf down, facing left. Then what?
Then comes step three, position at 1 meter.
1 meter away.
Yes. The drone uses its flight controllers to adjust its path and achieve a highly stable hover approximately 1 meter away from the target beetle.
Why 1 meter? Why not get closer?
It holds the standoff distance to avoid physically disturbing the plant with its propeller downwash while getting close enough for the optical systems to engage.
Oh, right, because if it blows the leaf around too much, the target moves.
Exactly. And that leads to step four, the actual event.
A moment of truth.
Step four is track and radiate. The internal optical system locks on to the beetle, tracks its micro movements in real time, and fires a focused laser beam to neutralize the insect.
Neutralize. I love the clinical engineering language.
It sounds better than zap.
It totally zaps the bug. But this radiation system itself, the internal hardware running that track and radiate loop, that is what really caught my attention in these papers. It's a masterpiece of miniaturized optical engineering.
It really is.
Let's look at what is actually packed into that 300-gram payload. They're using a 1550 nanometer laser diode as the weapon and a tracking camera as the eye.
Right.
But here's the genius part that I want to dig into. They both look into something called a dichroic combiner.
What's fascinating here is how the dichroic combiner solves one of the most maddening issues in optical engineering, which is alignment.
Alignment, like keeping them pointing at the same spot.
Exactly. If you have a camera and a laser mounted side by side, even slightly apart, they have different perspectives. It's called parallax.
Oh, like when you close one eye and then the other and your finger chumps.
Precisely. If the camera tells the laser to shoot exactly at the center of its view, the laser, being off to the side, will hit at a slightly different angle. When your target is a 2 millimeter beetle head, parallax error means you miss the bug and hit the leaf.
So how does the dichroic combiner fix that?
It uses the physics of light wavelengths. The combiner is a specialized piece of glass. It is engineered to reflect the invisible 1550 nanometer laser light, but it completely transmits visible light.
Okay, walk me through that.
So the camera sits behind this glass and looks straight through it to see the bug. The laser sits perpendicular to the glass and fires its beam into it, which then reflects the beam out toward the bug.
Oh, I see.
Because of this arrangement, the laser beam perfectly overlaps the camera's line of sight. They are coaxial.
It's like a one-way mirror in a police interrogation room, but tuned to specific colors of light instead of brightness.
That's a great way to put it.
The camera looks through the mirror, the laser bounces off the mirror, and they both travel down the exact same physical path. Where the camera looks is mathematically exactly where the laser fires.
Perfectly boresighted. And both the camera's view and the laser's beam are aimed together by bouncing off a tiny 7.5 millimeter moving mirror called a MEMS mirror.
So this tiny mechanical mirror is rapidly tilting on tiny hinges to keep the beam on the bug.
Yes, adjusting constantly.
But this brings up a huge logistical question. To keep this drone light, remember, you said it's only about 1 kilogram total. They had to strip out a lot of the heavy computing hardware, right?
They did.
Because processing 3D video in real time requires a lot of computing power, which means heavy chips, heavy heat sinks, heavy batteries. To avoid that, the drone only carries a tiny 6.5-gram stereo camera. The actual brain that crunches the 3D vision and figures out where the drone is in space is moved entirely offboard to a remote server.
That is correct. The drone streams its camera feed via a lightweight, high bandwidth data link to a server located either at the edge of the field or in the cloud.
In the cloud, for a drone flying over a farm.
Right. That server crunches the intense 3D spatial calculations and sends flight navigation instructions back to the drone. This architecture makes the physical drone incredibly cheap to manufacture, incredibly light, and highly upgradable.
Because you just upgrade the server.
Exactly. If you
Okay.
want a smarter drone, you just update the software on the central server. You don't have to recall and replace the processors on a fleet of 100 drones.
Okay, I have to stop you there because this seems like a glaring flaw.
Oh.
If the brain of this operation is sitting on a remote server miles away, what happens if there's lag?
Ugh, the latency question.
Yeah, we have all played video games online. We know what ping is. We are talking about a vibrating robot hovering over a field, trying to shoot a tiny bug that might be walking away. A fraction of a second delay in the wireless network, and that bug has moved.
And the laser misses.
Right. Doesn't the basic physics of network latency completely break this model?
It's a highly intuitive concern, and it's exactly the kind of bottleneck that would ruin the system if they hadn't anticipated it.
So how did they anticipate it?
To understand the solution, you have to realize that the engineers separated the operation into two entirely distinct loops. There's the navigation loop and the targeting loop. Okay. The remote server is only handling the macro-level navigation loop. It's doing the heavy 3D processing to tell the drone where it is relative to the ground and the plant canopy. That loop takes about 100 milliseconds to complete its round trip.
100 milliseconds, so mm-hmm. 1/10 of a second delay.
Yes. And for general drone guidance, just telling the flight controllers, drift 10 centimeters to the left to stay near this cluster of leaves, a 100 millisecond delay is perfectly acceptable.
Because the drone is just hovering, it's not performing acrobatics.
Exactly. But you are entirely correct that a 100 millisecond delay for the actual laser targeting would be disastrous. That is why the tracking of the tiny target with the MEMS mirror is absolutely not happening on the remote server.
So there was a local microbrain on the drone itself.
Exactly. The real-time micro-tracking and the control of that tiny steering mirror happened directly on board the 300-gram payload. They utilize a specialized, blisteringly fast chip called an FPGA, or a field-programmable gate array.
What makes an FPGA different from a normal computer chip?
Unlike a normal computer processor that handles a queue of different tasks, you know, waiting its turn, an FPGA is hardwired to do one specific math problem instantly.
Oh, wow.
The camera views the target, the FPGA directly processes the pixel shift, calculates the targeting error, and physically adjusts the MEMS mirror.
And how fast is that local loop running?
That closed loop updates every 4 milliseconds.
Every 4 milliseconds.
Yeah.
That is 250 times a second.
Right. So while the drone's physical body position is being managed by the remote server relatively slowly, the laser beam itself is being steered lightning fast by the local hardware.
It's just twitch reacting.
Yes. Even if the network lags or the drone sways, the beam tracks the beetle in real time, completely insulated from the slower server latency.
That makes total sense. You've decoupled the heavy thinking from the reflex actions.
Exactly.
But that brings us directly into the next massive hurdle, which is dealing with the physical realities of flight. We've got a lightweight drone hovering at 1 meter. I have flown consumer drones before.
You're jumpy.
They are not steady tripods at all. They are incredibly shaky. They buzz violently. They drift. They constantly fight their own turbulence in the ambient wind.
It's a harsh environment.
How on earth do you keep a microscopic laser focused on a millimeter-sized target from a platform that is vibrating that violently?
It sounds impossible until you break the movement down into its constituent parts.
Yeah, let's break it down.
The engineers categorize the drone's motion into two distinct types, high-frequency vibration and low-frequency motion. Because they are physically different phenomena, they are solved in completely different ways.
Okay, what is the high-frequency stuff?
High-frequency vibration is the buzzing you mentioned. This occurs anywhere from 100 to over 500 hertz. It is generated by the rapid spinning of the electric motors, the aerodynamic chop of the propellers, and the structural resonance of the drone's plastic arms.
It's the angry hornet sensation when you hold the drone.
Yes, exactly. And the solution to that angry hornet vibration is surprisingly low-tech, purely mechanical, and incredibly mature.
Oh, really? No fancy chips for that?
Nope. You isolate the payload physically, you mount the entire optical block, the camera, the laser, the mirrors, on specialized rubber vibration isolation pads.
Rubber pads?
Just rubber pads. This is not new technology. It is the industry standard used in almost all professional drone gimbals for cinematography.
Right, to keep the camera smooth.
By tuning the stiffness of these rubber pads, the high-frequency vibration is absorbed and attenuated by 20 to 60 decibels before it ever reaches the sensitive optical components.
So for the high-frequency stuff, you basically just put the whole 300-gram payload on tiny-tuned shock absorbers.
Basically, yes. The high-frequency jitter is mechanically filtered out. It simply doesn't reach the laser.
Okay, but what about the big movements?
Right. Then you have the low-frequency motion. This is the movement in the 0.1 to 20 hertz range. This is the entire drone drifting, swaying, bobbing up and down, reacting to gusts of wind, or just naturally maneuvering in the air.
And you absolutely cannot filter out low-frequency sway with a rubber pad.
No, the whole pad moves with the drone.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because I was trying to picture this mentally while reading the sources. The high-frequency vibration is like the uncontrollable jitters you get in your hands after drinking 4 double espressos.
Okay, I like this.
Right. You can fix that by resting your hands on a heavy, soft cushion. It absorbs the jitter. But the low-frequency motion is entirely different. It's like trying to stand upright on the deck of a boat in a heady ocean swell. You don't put a cushion under the boat to stop the waves. You use your knees and your eyes to constantly adjust your body weight and balance in real time as the deck pitches and rolls beneath you.
That is a brilliant analogy, and it perfectly describes what the system is doing. That is where that incredibly fast 4-millisecond FPGA closed loop comes back into play.
The reflex brain.
Because the low frequency motion, the wind sway, is relatively slow compared to electronic speeds. So the fast tracking loop continuously steers the MEMS mirror to cancel out that motion in real time.
Because 4 milliseconds is way faster than a gust of wind.
Exactly. The slow relative motion of the drone does not need to be mechanically removed. It is electronically tracked out of the equation. The beam is locked onto the target's coordinates, independent of the drone's orientation.
Let me make sure I have this. Even if a sudden gust of wind pushes the entire drone 6 inches to the left, the camera sees that shift. The FPGA calculates it, and the MEMS mirror tilts instantly in the opposite direction to keep the laser pinned on the exact same millimeter of the beetle's head, all within 4 milliseconds.
Precisely. The drone moves, but the beam stays perfectly anchored. And we know this isn't just theoretical math. It has been rigorously tested and de-risked in the real world.
Really? How do they test it?
Independent researchers, specifically authors of a 2023 paper on a system called Fovicam plus 2AT, proved that event-based FPGA tracking holds a visual lock even under extreme artificially induced heavy vibration.
Like they were shaking it on purpose.
Yes. They proved that closed-loop optical aiming remains incredibly stable even on a wildly moving platform.
And the data shows they actually did manual tests to prove the stabilization, didn't they?
They did, and the results are really eye-opening. To prove that inherent drone vibration wasn't an unsolvable blocker, they set up an indoor greenhouse-style test environment. They took a standard off-the-shelf DJI Mini 3 drone and fixed a downward-pointing laser to it. No active beam steering mirror at all. Just a laser rigidly bolted to the drone frame.
Just a laser pointer strapped to a drum?
Basically. A human pilot manually steered the drone left and right, hovering over the floor, and the human was able to hold the laser spot relatively steady on a 1 millimeter target spot.
Wait, a human pilot with a standard remote control could hold a drone steady enough to keep a fixed laser on a 1 millimeter dot?
Yes. Indoors, without wind, the human could achieve that precision.
That's crazy.
What this simple experiment demonstrated is that high-frequency vibration from the motors and props is already a solved problem by the drone's basic dampening. It doesn't ruin the aim. The real primary challenge outdoors is simply wind pushing the drone around.
But since we just established that the fast FPGA and the MEMS mirror can easily compensate for that low-frequency wind sway electronically, precise beam steering becomes a perfectly solvable engineering problem.
Exactly.
It is not a fundamental blocker that defies physics.
No, it's completely solvable.
Okay, so we have established that the system is incredibly precise, it is heavily stabilized against wind and vibration, and it is insanely fast. The mechanics work. But now that we know it works, we have to address the giant, terrifying question that I know every single person listening to this is currently thinking.
I know what you're going to ask.
Is it safe?
It is arguably the most important question of this entire deep dive.
Because when you summarize it, we are talking about deploying autonomous flying robots that are firing lasers randomly in open farmland.
It sounds a little dystopian.
Sounds like the inciting incident of a sci-fi horror movie where a hiker takes a wrong turn into a cornfield and gets vaporized. How do we know this technology isn't going to blind bystanders, burn down the crops in the middle of summer, or just cause absolute chaos?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of autonomous robotics, safety is never about a single perfect safeguard. It is always about redundancy.
Layering it up.
The developers of this system have built what they call a 7-layer safety architecture. It is a gauntlet of multiple independent physical and software systems that must all align perfectly for the laser to fire. When you combine them, the danger to humans becomes virtually theoretical.
Let's walk through these layers because the way they overlap is fascinating. I want to start with the physics of the light itself. The laser uses a 1550 nanometer wavelength.
Right.
Why that specific number? Why not just use a standard visible laser or a more common near-infrared one?
The choice of 1550 nanometers is the bedrock of the entire safety system because it exploits the biology of the human eye.
How so?
Visible light, like a green or red laser or near-infrared lasers, pass directly through the clear cornea and the lens of your eye. The eye acts like a magnifying glass, focusing all that laser energy into a microscopic, intensely hot point directly on your retina at the back of the eye.
And that's bad.
That causes instant, irreversible, permanent blindness. But 1550 nanometer light behaves differently. The water molecules inside the front of your eye, specifically in the cornea, are highly opaque to 1550 nanometer light. They absorb it completely.
So the light stops at the surface. It physically cannot penetrate deep enough to reach the retina.
Exactly.
Okay, so it fundamentally cannot reach the back of the eye to cause permanent blindness. But what about the front of the eye? If the water absorbs the energy, doesn't it heat up?
It does. The worst case scenario with this specific wavelength is front of eye exposure, which can cause surface thermal burns to the cornea.
Ouch.
I won't sugarcoat it. That would be painful. But a corneal burn, much like welder's flash, is medically and surgically treatable. The cornea can heal or be repaired. It is not permanent, life-altering blindness. That physical limitation is a massive, fundamental safety advantage.
That makes a lot of sense. But even a treatable burn isn't great. Which brings in the geometry of the beam itself, right? We usually think of lasers like a laser pointer, a tight beam that travels perfectly parallel for hundreds of feet. But this system doesn't do that, does it?
No, it intentionally avoids parallel beams. The optics are designed so that the beam starts relatively wide as it exits the drone's payload.
Okay.
It then converges, focusing down to a microscopic, incredibly tight and intense spot exactly at the 1 meter target distance where the beetle is. But crucially, immediately after that 1 meter focal point, the beam diverges rapidly. It spreads out into a wide cone.
So the danger zone is incredibly small.
Exactly. Past that 1 meter mark, the optical energy density drops off an absolute cliff. If you are a human standing 3 meters away from the drone, the beam has spread out so much that the energy hitting any one part of your eye or skin is too diffuse to cause harm.
It's just a warm glow at that point.
Exactly. The hazard is geometrically restricted to a tiny bubble directly beneath the drone.
Which perfectly leads into the next safeguard, the orientation. What happens if the drone malfunctions and points sideways at a passing car on a country road?
The physical gimbal and the software simply do not allow it. The laser is hard-coded to only fire downward, toward the crop canopy.
What if it gets knocked over?
Furthermore, the drone is constantly measuring its own position and orientation in three-dimensional space using its inertial measurement units, roughly 300 times per second. If it detects any sudden unexpected disturbance, let's say a bird collides with it or a massive gust of wind flips it past a safe operating angle, the power to the laser is severed in about 1 millisecond. It physically cannot fire while out of orientation.
And even if it was falling, a 1 millisecond flash isn't long enough to transfer dangerous heat.
Precisely. And there's an additional physics quirk here. If the laser accidentally hits a highly reflective surface in the field, say, a piece of farm equipment, and bounces toward a person, the natural wobble of the hovering drone means the reflected spot is also in continuous sweeping motion.
Oh, because the drone is swaying.
A moving reflected spot simply cannot dwell on a human eye long enough to deliver harmful thermal energy. It sweeps past too fast.
Okay, so the physics of the light and the geometry of the beam make accidental exposure incredibly difficult. But what about the AI? Let's say a farmer's kid leaves a plastic toy in the field, or there's a piece of trash. Is the drone going to start blasting a discarded soda can and start a fire?
This is where the machine learning models take over. The drone is programmed with strict AI scenery validation. It is trained to recognize and only authorize firing upon verified natural field scenery leaves, soil, stems.
It won't shoot garbage.
The AI actively recognizes and blocks abnormal objects. If the camera sees a bicycle, a cattle water tub, a discarded doll, a necklace, a broken glass bottle, or an aluminum can, it completely blocks the firing mechanism.
It just acts as a total failsafe. It refuses to shoot unless it knows it's looking at a plant.
Correct. But looking at a plant isn't enough. It also has to find the bug. Before a shot is authorized, the target validation AI must verify that a specific anatomical feature, specifically the beetle's head, is present in the camera frame.
Wait, it looks for the head specifically.
Yes. And it doesn't just look for round and dark. It actively scans for and rejects any round eye-like patterns to ensure it isn't accidentally targeting a reflection or a pattern on a piece of clothing. If there is no confirmed high-confidence biological match for a beetle head, no laser shot is fired.
So it won't shoot at a shiny rock or a polka dot shirt.
Definitely not.
And once it does fire, we have that closed-loop tracking we talked about earlier.
Yes, that 4-millisecond loop isn't just for accuracy, it's a critical safety feature. Every 4 milliseconds, the system checks if the visual lock is still centered on the target.
And if it's not?
If the beetle drops off the leaf or a leaf blows in the way, and the visual lock is lost for even a fraction of a second, the laser stops immediately. The loop is far too fast for hazardous misexposure to build up on the surrounding environment.
Okay, what if a farm worker just walks out into the field while the drones are working?
The drones are equipped with an array of 4 360-degree cameras that are continuously monitoring the surrounding macroscopic environment.
So it sees them coming.
If a human figure is detected anywhere within a 5-meter radius of the drone, it creates an automatic no-fire exclusion zone. The system simply shuts down its offensive capabilities, maintains a safe hover, or flies away until the human is entirely clear of the area.
Wow. So when you stack all of this up, the retina-safe 1550 nanometer wavelength, the geometrically diverging beam, the downward-only mechanical limit, the 1 millisecond disturbance shutdown, the AI scenery validation, the biological target validation, the 4 millisecond track loss shutdown, and the 5-meter human detection radius. The chance of an accident isn't just low, it requires a miraculous sequence of simultaneous failures.
Exactly. As the engineers noted in their safety filings, a well-designed, redundant system like this is actually significantly safer than technologies we interact with daily, like self-driving cars.
Really? That's a bold claim. Why is it safer than a self-driving car?
Because the physical consequences of a failure are vastly smaller, and the decision loop is much simpler. Think about a self-driving car. It is a 2-ton block of metal moving at 60 miles an hour, mere feet from unprotected pedestrians.
Yeah, that's a lot of kinetic energy.
If the car's AI makes a mistake, the kinetic energy involved makes the failure instantly catastrophic and lethal. This drone, by contrast, weighs 1 kilogram. It hovers slowly over a private-controlled agricultural field, and its weapon is a tiny, diverging, retina-safe beam of light pointed at the dirt. If the drone fails completely and falls out of the sky, it might crush a single potato plant.
Speaking of the plant, that is the one safety aspect we haven't touched on. You have a laser hot enough to instantly kill a bug. Aren't we going to set the field on fire? We are talking about agriculture here. In late summer, fields can be incredibly dry. Dry leaves, hot sun, focused laser. Sounds like a recipe for a wildfire.
That was obviously a major concern for the developers and a huge part of the physical de-risking tests. They ran extensive thermal trials on the crops.
And what did they find?
It turns out living potato leaves are remarkably robust and full of water. In the tests, exposing the leaves to the laser did not cause them to ignite, and it showed no meaningful long-term harm to the plant's vascular system.
So it doesn't just instantly burst into flames.
No, agriculture leaves in a growing field are generally not combustible in that manner. They dissipate heat too well. Furthermore, potato plants are incredibly resilient. Agronomic studies show that a potato plant can lose about 10% of its total leaf surface area to minor damage without experiencing any practical harm to the final crop yield.
Oh, interesting.
So even if the laser occasionally caused a tiny pinpoint burn spot on a leaf while tracking a bug, the economic effect on the plant is zero.
And the bug itself, how much energy does it actually take to kill it?
The physics of the target actually work heavily in our favor here. The shell of the Colorado potato beetle happens to absorb about 25% of the specific 1550 nanometer light wavelength.
That's a high absorption rate.
It is. Based on the thermal modeling in the research, it only takes about one single joule of energy to heat the beetle's tiny head by 30 degrees Celsius.
And 30 degrees Celsius is enough to do the job.
Yes. A sudden localized spike of 30 degrees Celsius causes rapid thermal inactivation of the insect's central nervous system in about 100 milliseconds.
Rapid inactivation. Again, you instantly cook the bug's brain, but leave the water-filled plant totally fine. That is an incredible exploitation of physical property.
It really is.
So we know it's mechanically possible, we know it's incredibly fast, and we know it's exceptionally safe. But here is where the rubber meets the road. Farmers aren't just technologists looking for cool gadgets. They are running businesses, often with incredibly tight, unforgiving margins.
Yes, the economics have to make sense.
Which brings us to the economics and the strategy. Why go through the massive hassle of building a flying drone for this? Why not just put this exact same laser camera system on a ground-based robot cart? Ground robots are everywhere in ag tech right now. They roam the fields, they zap weeds. Why take to the sky?
It's a fantastic question, and this is where the structural advantages of flight become an absolute economic superpower for pest control.
Okay, tell me why.
To understand why, let's look at the theoretical laser cart. Ground systems seem easier, but they succumb to what engineers call a vicious cycle of mass.
A vicious cycle of mass. Explain that.
Because a ground cart has wheels or tracks, it has to push through physical resistance. Agricultural fields are not paved roads. They are matty. They have deep tractor ruts. They are uneven.
Right.
To push through thick mud, a cart needs large, powerful electric motors. Large motors require massive, heavy batteries to run for an entire day. But adding massive batteries makes the cart heavier, which means it sinks deeper into the mud, which means it needs even bigger motors to get unstuck, which requires even more batteries.
Right. It just gets heavier and heavier. Until you basically have a small tractor.
Exactly. And because it's heavy and slow, it pays a huge operational time penalty. When the massive battery finally does run low, the cart might have to travel 1 to 2 kilometers at a walking pace through dense mud just to reach a charging station at the edge of the field.
That's a lot of wasted time.
And crucially, in a dense crop like potatoes, the physical passage of a ground robot causes immense crop contact damage. It bends stems, it crushes leaves, and it wounds the plants.
And plant wounds are bad news.
Terrible news. Those physical wounds create entry points for devastating fungal infections, which then forces the farmer to spend thousands of dollars spraying fungicides. So the cart is heavy, it's slow, it spends half its day driving to a charger, and it damages the very crop it's trying to protect.
Compare that to the physical reality of the laser drone.
The drone is the antithesis of the cart. It is incredibly small, weighing roughly 1 kilogram. From a maintenance perspective, that is revolutionary. If a ground cart breaks an axle, you need a mechanic with a truck to come to the field.
Oh, that's expensive.
If a 1 kilogram drone breaks, the farmer can literally put it in a standard cardboard box and mail it to a service center.
Wow.
Because it flies above the canopy, it is completely terrain and crop independent. Wet soil after a rainstorm, rough ground, wildly uneven rows, it doesn't matter to the drone. It simply floats over it all. It never physically touches the crop, meaning zero mechanical damage and zero fungal entry points.
And what about the power consumption? Because flying takes energy.
It does, but because the drone is so incredibly light, its total energy requirement is tiny. It only draws about 40 to 250 watts in flight.
That's like a light bulb.
And because it flies directly, point to point over the crops without having to navigate mud or follow tractor rows, it can easily dart back to a small solar charging station just 400 meters away. Frequent, short, 5-minute recharge cycles are entirely practical.
So what does this fundamental difference in mobility mean for the actual day-to-day strategy of pest management on the farm?
It creates a massive paradigm shift from a catch-up strategy to a prevent strategy.
Okay, walk me through that.
To visualize this, imagine a scenario where a new adult Colorado potato beetle flies into a field every 10 minutes from the surrounding woods, landing at a random point on the perimeter.
Just trickling in.
These are called founder insects. They are the seeds of an infestation. If you leave them alone, they eat, they lay hundreds of eggs. Those eggs hatch, and suddenly you have a localized explosion of pests.
Okay, how does a ground cart handle those founder insects?
Poorly. The cart is forced to use a catch-up strategy. Because the cart moves slowly and is physically constrained by the rows, it cannot just dart across 50 acres to kill one single bug. It would take an hour to get there.
So what does the farmer do?
The economics of the cart force the farmer to wait. They have to wait until the insect population grows and reaches what is called an economic threshold, a certain high density of pests, to justify sending the slow, heavy cart on a full field traversal mission.
Oh, I see.
It is a batch-driven logic. The cost of running the cart is tied strictly to the area it has to cover, regardless of how many bugs are there.
So what you're saying is, a cart is like waiting until a massive house party is completely out of control, windows are broken, and the neighbors are screaming before you finally call the riot police. Because it takes too long to get the trucks there and suit everybody up, you can't justify calling them for one loud guest.
That is exactly the dynamic, but the drone completely flips that dynamic because it uses a prevent strategy.
Okay, how does the prevent strategy work?
The drone's operation is event-driven. The moment the scouting system detects a single founder insect, a laser drone launches, flies directly over the canopy at high speed, neutralizes that one specific bug, and immediately returns to base.
That is so fast.
It is a short, targeted, surgical mission. It removes the founders before they have any chance to create local clusters or lay eggs. The population essentially stays near zero all season.
So what does this all mean? The drone is like having an incredibly observant bouncer at the door of a club who quietly walks over and removes the one single troublemaker the exact second they walk in, before they even have a chance to order a drink or start a fight.
Yes, perfect analogy. For sparse, emerging, or clustered pest populations, the drone's structural advantage is undeniable. The operational cost of a ground cart scales with the area it has to traverse. The operational cost of a laser drone scales purely with the number of insects it has to
And the
neutralize.
financial numbers actually back this up, don't they? I was looking at the economic models in the research, specifically the simulation they ran using real-world data.
Yes, the developers ran a highly detailed simulation using factual field data from an agricultural company called AgriScout.
Real farm data?
Exactly. They looked at a real 93-acre potato field and extrapolated the actual beetle counts throughout a season. Assuming a pessimistic, worst-case scenario where the beetles were uniformly distributed across the entire field rather than clustered, they calculated the drone's flight dynamics.
So they assumed the hardest possible job for the drone.
They did. They factored in the hop distance between plants, the acceleration curves, and the battery wear. To neutralize every single target on that 93-acre field across the season, the drone would require a total of 7.73 flight hours.
And what does one flight hour actually cost in real dollars?
When the engineers factored in everything hardware depreciation, the replacement cost of batteries over hundreds of cycles, motor wear and tear, and general maintenance, the working cost of the drone is approximately €3 per flight hour.
Wait, let me make sure I heard that right. 3 euros an hour. That is insanely cheap for autonomous robotics.
It is remarkably cheap because the hardware is so light and simple. When you run the math on those 7.73 hours at €3 an hour, the pure neutralization flight cost comes out to about €2.61 per treated hectare.
Unbelievable.
Even when the economic models add in the overhead cost of the separate scanning drones needed to find the bugs in the first place, and they apply highly conservative, pessimistic ceilings to the math to account for real-world friction, the estimated all-in cost of the system is roughly €3 to €4 per treated hectare.
Wow.
The absolute most conservative worst-case ceiling they calculated is €9 per hectare.
3 to 9 euros per hectare to surgically permanently remove the pests without a single drop of chemical. How does that compare to the alternatives? Because I hear a lot about sustainable farming using biological controls, like introducing predatory nematodes or beneficial insects to eat the beetles.
Biological alternatives like nematodes are excellent ecologically, but they are economically brutal. Applying nematodes can cost a farmer between 250 and €300 per hectare.
Oh, wow. So 3 euros versus 300 euros.
So treating insects one by one with a laser drone isn't just a fun sci-fi tech demo. It is an economic juggernaut. It is vastly cheaper than treating entire hectares, even when compared to the greenest biological alternatives on the market.
That is the ultimate turning point right there. It's not just greener for the environment, it's vastly cheaper for the bottom line. You don't have to convince a farmer to take a financial hit to save the bees. You are offering them a cheaper tool that happens to save the bee.
Exactly. It's a win-win.
But you don't just launch a radical technology like this everywhere all at once. You need a starting point. You need a beachhead market where the economics make undeniable sense on day one to prove the system works at scale. And that initial target is the bug we've been talking about this whole time, the Colorado potato beetle.
The CPB is the absolute perfect first target for this technology.
Why is that?
From an engineering standpoint, it is highly visible. It sits right on top of the green leaf, making it easy for the cameras to spot. From an agricultural standpoint, it causes massive rapid defoliation damage, which motivates farmers to pay for a solution.
Right.
And from a chemical standpoint, as we discussed, it is notoriously resistant to almost everything on the market. The addressable market for managing this one single pest, just in Europe and the USA, is roughly 2.09 million hectares of farmland.
And the business model outlined here isn't about manufacturing millions of drones and selling them to individual farmers, right?
Okay.
It's a service model.
Correct. Modern farming is rapidly shifting towards service models, often called farming as a service. A farmer doesn't want to become a drone mechanic or an IT specialist.
No, they want to farm.
The proposed model is a subscription. The farmer pays a flat rate of 100 euros per hectare per season. For that fee, the tech company brings the drones, sets up the base stations, manages the software, and provides full guaranteed CPB control for the entire growing season.
And if the cost to the company is as low as we just discussed, the profit margins must be huge.
They are. The estimated internal cost for the tech company to deliver that season-long service, factoring in hardware, personnel, and logistics, is only about 20 euros per hectare.
So they charge 100, it costs 20.
That yields a software-like gross margin of 80%.
An 80% margin in agriculture is unheard of. And at 2.09 million hectares, that represents a 209 million euro per year revenue potential. That's just the initial beachhead market, just for one bug on one crop in two regions.
Exactly. And the environmental impact of securing that beachhead is staggering.
Tell me about the environmental impact.
If they capture that market, that single operation avoids the spraying of approximately 2,500 tons of formulated toxic insecticide every single season.
2,500 tons. That's massive.
That means 2,500 tons of chemicals not entering the water table, no toxic residues on the food, no collateral harm to beneficial pollinating insects, and zero risk of chemical exposure to the farm workers applying it.
And after they conquer the potato beetle, where does the technology go next?
The expansion opportunities are massive. The engineering teams are targeting the yellow stem borer in rice as the immediate next step.
Why the rice borer?
Rice stem borers lay stationary, highly exposed egg masses on the leaves of rice plants. They are perfect, immobile targets for a laser. That rice market alone represents a $600 to $700 million a year opportunity.
No.
From there, you scale the AI to recognize stink bugs, fall armyworms, fruit moths, and orchards. The total global insecticide market is valued at over $14 billion annually. The ceiling for this technology is astronomical.
But here is where the story takes a truly wild, unexpected turn. The laser drone isn't just about replacing chemical sprays or saving money on insecticides. While I was reading through these sources, I hit an absolute aha moment regarding something called true potato seed, or TPS.
This is where the systems-level impact of the laser technology truly shines. The drone isn't just a better pest trap, it is the key that unlocks an entirely new, vastly superior method of global farming.
Let's unpack true potato seed, because honestly, before reading this, I had no idea how potatoes were actually planted at a commercial scale. I just assumed you went to a store, bought a packet of little seeds, and put them in the dirt like carrots or tomatoes.
Most people assume that because that's how almost every other crop works. But currently, commercial potatoes are vegetatively propagated. They're essentially cloned.
Cloned.
Farmers have to plant actual physical pieces of potatoes, which are called seed tubers. To plant 1 hectare of a potato field, a farmer has to buy, transport, and physically bury 2 to 3 tons of these heavy, bulky, water-filled tubers.
2 to 3 tons of physical potatoes just to plant 1 hectare. That is an absolute logistical nightmare. You need fleets of heavy trucks, massive climate-controlled storage barns, and specialized heavy machinery just to get the seeds into the ground.
It is extremely labor and resource intensive.
And on top of that, they are expensive, right?
Incredibly expensive. High input budgets for purchasing certified seed tubers can easily reach 1,800 to 2,100 euros per hectare. They often represent the single largest share of a potato farmer's production cost.
Wow.
Furthermore, because you are planting a wet, fleshy piece of a plant, they are perfect vectors for carrying and spreading tuber-borne diseases from one generation to the next.
So what exactly is true potato seed and how does it fix this?
True potato seed, or TPS, means abandoning the tuber clones and planting actual botanical seeds from the flower of the potato plant, just like you would with a tomato.
Just a normal seed.
Yes. If you switch to TPS, instead of hauling 3 tons of tubers, you only need between 25 and 100 grams of seed to plant an entire hectare.
100 grams? You could literally hold the seeds for an entire industrial farm field in the palm of your hand.
Exactly. The reduction in logistics and shipping emissions is staggering. Plus, botanical seeds do not transmit the vast majority of tuber-borne diseases, so you start with a much healthier crop.
That sounds amazing.
But the absolute biggest, most revolutionary advantage of TPS is genetic.
How so?
When you clone tubers, you are stuck with the exact genetics of the parent. It takes decades to breed a new variety. With TPS, you can use modern hybrid breeding techniques to quickly stack highly desirable traits into the seeds.
Like what kind of treats?
The holy grail of potato breeding is stacking resistance to late blight. Late blight is a devastating, fast-moving fungal disease. It is literally the pathogen that caused the Irish potato famine in the 1840s. It destroys crops overnight.
Terrifying.
Today, to prevent late blight, farmers are forced to spray massive amounts of harsh fungicides constantly throughout the season.
It's a huge environmental and financial burden.
It is. But if farmers could easily plant blight-resistant TPS varieties, they could reduce their fungicide use by up to 50%, which saves roughly 190 euros per hectare in chemical costs alone, not to mention the environmental benefit.
Okay, stop right there. If true potato seed is this incredible miracle, if you can hold the seeds in your hand, if it saves thousands of euros on buying heavy tubers, if it stops tuber diseases, and if it saves hundreds of euros on fungicides, why on earth aren't farmers already using it everywhere? Why are we still planting 3 tons of clones?
Because of one critical, devastating biological vulnerability phase. The industry calls it the Colorado potato beetle bottleneck.
Ah, the beetle strikes again.
When you plant TPS, the plants start their life as incredibly tiny, fragile, delicate seedlings, or they're grown in nurseries and transplant as tiny plugs.
So they're super small.
Very small. These young seedlings are vastly smaller and infinitely more vulnerable than a robust plant pushing up from a massive, energy-dense tuber. And here is the tragic timing. Exactly when those incredibly vulnerable seedlings are emerging from the soil, the overwintering adult Colorado potato beetles are also emerging from their winter hibernation in the soil, and they are ravenously hungry.
And a tiny seedling stands zero chance against a hungry adult beetle.
None. A single adult CPB or its larva can completely defoliate and kill these delicate seedlings in a matter of hours.
Hours.
Yes. And because the beetles are so highly resistant to modern insecticides, traditional chemical sprays often fail to protect the plants during this critical early window. The chemical just doesn't kill the bug fast enough to save the tiny plant.
So the plants die before the chemical even works.
Therefore, the immense, unstoppable CPB pressure is the primary barrier preventing the adoption of TPS in many high-pressure agricultural regions around the world. Farmers simply cannot risk their entire crop being eaten in the first week.
And this is exactly where the laser drone sweeps over the hill like the cavalry.
Precisely. The laser drone provides the exact, selective, high-frequency, low-input protection that these highly vulnerable seedlings desperately need to survive their infancy.
Because it's on watch 24/7.
The drone can scout the field constantly, find those hungry founder beetles the moment they emerge, and surgically neutralize them without spraying a single drop of chemical that might stunt the delicate young plants or disrupt the surrounding soil ecosystem.
So what you're saying is the laser drone isn't just a neat pest control tool. It is the missing structural enabling component for a much larger revolution.
Yes. If the autonomous laser drone solves the CPB bottleneck, it actively unlocks the widespread global adoption of true potato seed.
That's incredible.
And TPS, in turn, unlocks a fundamentally lower cost, vastly lower fungicide, higher yield global potato farming system. The laser drone is the keystone technology holding the future of sustainable potato agriculture together.
That is absolutely mind-blowing. We start this conversation looking at an infographic of a tiny robot shooting a bug with a laser, and we end up uncovering a pathway to completely reinventing the global supply chain of one of the world's most vital staple crops. It's the ultimate technological domino effect.
Which I think brings us perfectly to the conclusion of our deep dive today. When you step back and look at the totality of this information, the 4-millisecond optical aiming loop, the physics of the 1550 nanometer safety architecture, the astonishing 3-year-an-hour economics, and the potential to unlock the true potato seed revolution, what is your biggest takeaway from all these sources?
My biggest takeaway is that this is no longer a sci-fi pipe dream. The engineering specs spell it out perfectly. Photonic insecticides do not require us to wait for 7 missing impossible inventions. We aren't sitting around waiting for a miracle, physics-defying battery, or a new law of thermodynamics to be discovered.
Exactly. The most critical pieces of the autonomy stack already exist in the real world today. We already have commercial scouting drones flying over fields. We have reliable automatic outdoor docking and charging stations. We have incredibly precise stereo cameras. And we have blisteringly fast FPGA processors. The individual parts are mature.
The remaining gap is simply an integration challenge. It is an engineering hurdle. not a fundamental science fiction fantasy. It's just about connecting mature scouting tech, docking tech, and tracking tech to create a precise, safe, low-cost optical kill loop.
And when they finally close that loop and scale it, we are truly looking at the end of the chemical era of broad-area, untargeted spraying.
Which is huge.
We are looking at a tangible, economically viable transition to a truly sustainable, biodiversity-supporting model of global agriculture. We can finally stop treating the hectare and start precisely treating the insect.
It is incredibly hopeful. And, you know, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to ponder as we wrap up this exploration.
I love a good final thought.
We started this conversation by comparing the blunt, toxic chaos of a crop duster to the clinical, localized precision of a medical X-ray. We are now actively building platforms that can visually identify, track, and physically interact with a single specific biological organism down to the exact millimeter from the air, completely autonomously.
The era of absolute precision has arrived in the field.
But what happens when we flip the script on that precision? If we can engineer all of this incredible technology, the lasers, the FPGAs, the AI, just to eliminate a pest, what if tomorrow's drone isn't shooting a high-powered laser to destroy a bug? What if that exact same tracking system is instead firing a microscopic targeted burst of a specific liquid nutrient or biological healing agent to cure a single disease lease on a single plant?
Oh, wow.
We've successfully managed to digitize and automate death in the crop field. How long until we use these exact same tools to digitize life?
This raises an important question indeed. The fundamental platform is there. The optical lock is proven. The applications going forward are entirely boundless.
It's definitely something to think about the next time you see a small drone buzzing in the sky over a farm. Thanks for joining us on this exploration of the sources. Keep questioning the consensus, keep digging into the details, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.